Hey guys, and welcome to Hunting Land, presented by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. If you'd like to stay up to date on hunting tactics, land management, land values, and land market dynamics, this is the podcast for you. This week's show is brought to you by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. If you're frustrated with typical hunting and fishing magazines and tired of reading content, meant for guys that are up in the north or up in the Midwest, check out Great Days Outdoors Magazine. Don't get left behind following the guidance of guys who don't fish or hunt in your home state. You can pick up a Great Days Outdoors Magazine subscription, and it will help you become a better Southern outdoorsman. Great Days Outdoors Magazine can be found at your local Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Tractor Supply Company, Rural King, Bass Pro Shops, or you can save online at greatdaysoutdoors.com. If you're looking for a beautiful state that's packed with outdoor attractions, check out Mississippi. Of course, you know about the Mississippi River, but there are a lot of great rivers for paddling throughout the state. Coastal Mississippi's waters are perfect for deep-sea fishing or exploring the state's five uninhabited barrier islands. You'll find national forests with campgrounds, trails, and recreational sites, 25 state parks, and wildlife management areas, too. Whatever you like to do in the great outdoors, you can do in Mississippi, where wanderers are welcome. Plan your adventure at visitmississippi.org/outdoors. Ayer Medcare. Did you know every 40 seconds someone has a heart attack or stroke? In that moment, every second counts and every critical decision matters. Ayer Medcare Network's air ambulance providers can bring life-saving care directly to those in need at a moment's notice. With 320 locations across 38 states, they're the largest air ambulance membership network. Rest assured, they've got you and your entire household covered. Membership is just $99 a year or just $79 for seniors. Visit gdo.deals/airmedcare to enroll. I'm your host, Joe Baia, here today with my co-host, Butch Theory. Butch, I got chigger bites all over me. I'm itching. Found 8 seed ticks on me the other day. I went into a favorite hardwood bottom of mine. It's a big white oak back there that when it drops, it is just... it's amazing, man. I mean, it's like having a feeder in the woods. You know, every animal from deer to turkeys to raccoons to pigs, I mean, they just all come to this tree. And I got there and found that sucker laying on the ground. It made me really sad. Oh, you no. know, it's kind of funny. I think I have 8 or 9 tree stands on my place, actual lock-on type stands. And who knows? I mean, how many trees are on a couple hundred acres? 80,000? I don't know. You know what I mean?
A lot.
And one of the trees that had one of my lock-ons in fell over and hit the ground. You know,
so your hunting season's off to a great start.
So first things first, I had to go, and I had that stand just positioned just like I liked it near that white oak. Now I had to rethink the whole thing. I'm out there, and it was funny because my wife was there with my two little boys, and I was hanging up that new stand, and I'm like, you know, hey, Stephanie, you know, go over there and like, look. And she's looking at me like, when are you going to be done? And I'm like, I need you to walk totally to the other side, you know, over there. Can you just, you know, envision you're the deer, you know, and yeah, we're
get
like,
that, get down on all fours and right. Walk down this trail and see
rub,
if you can see me.
Rub that tree over there. No, but I mean, really, that's some of the things that I think about every time I'm setting up a bow stand is like, we gotta make sure we're thinking about all these factors so that I feel confident when I'm sitting here that I'm not going to get busted, because I'm investing tick bites and chigger bites and a lot of sweat and a lot of energy to get this stand up. I want to make sure I get it up right, and hopefully I don't have to do it again.
Yeah. Tis the season, man. We're trimming limbs and, you know, putting up our lock-ons and making sure they're safe and, you know, picking out shooting lanes, shooting lanes that we're going to be able to, you know, get a deer with, and making sure all our lock-ons are nice and hidden. And yeah, tis the season, man.
A lot of fun. That's one of the, I enjoy the prep as much as the hunting itself personally.
Yeah, it's all part of the process.
You know, but today's show is going to be really interesting because we're going to get into the science behind how deer see. And
yeah, we're going to see if we've been doing this thing right as far as setting up our stands go.
Yeah. Are some of the things you thought you knew true, or some, can you learn something about the way you're setting up your stands or making your stalks, positioning even down to the height of your stand? We're really going to dig in on this and find out, based on science, how deer see and what you can do with this information to make your hunting, stand placement, camouflage more effective. All right, and to do that today, we are talking with Gino D'Angelo, Associate Professor of Deer Ecology and Management at the Warnell School of Forestry and Natural Resources at the University of Georgia. Gino, thanks for joining us today, man. Tell us a little bit first about your background, how you got into this. That's a cool, it's a cool job. I mean, everybody loves to be able to find a way to combine something that they're passionate about with something that they're able to do to make a living. I would assume that you're passionate about whitetails, maybe just deer as a whole, maybe just all around. How'd you get into this?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, guys. And I am highly passionate about deer. In fact, I was rearranging my calendar today to make sure I had enough time in muzzleloader and gun season and what's left of archery to make sure I get out in the woods. So it is what drives me every day. But I grew up in Pennsylvania, big deer state, in a hunting family with a strong conservation attitude, and just spending my time around the coal strippings looking for deer as a young kid. And learning the tracks and just getting to know their behavior. And that led me to Penn State, where I did my bachelor's, and I lived and worked at the deer research facility there. Did my grad school, both my master's and PhD at University of Georgia. Left Georgia, worked for US Department of Agriculture, mostly managing overabundant whitetail deer on the Eastern Seaboard. And then I was deer research project leader in the state of Minnesota, helping to manage deer and elk for the state before I returned to University of Georgia, where I'm on the faculty. So I spend much of my time researching whitetail deer, their habitats, predators, mentoring graduate and undergraduate students, and now I direct our captive deer research facility where we do a lot of this vision work that we're going to talk about today.
That's a very cool background. You know, I think we've all been in that scenario where a deer just immediately spots you and you're like, how in the world, you know, did that sucker see me? I mean, sometimes I feel like I've done a great job setting up my tree stand, got all my full camo, and it's like the deer just locks in on me and you know you're busted immediately. And then other times,
Yeah, because I've seen it go the completely opposite
yeah,
way where
you're
I'm
sitting
like,
there
man,
going,
how did he
ha.
not see that?
And yeah, we've all probably, you know, shot a deer in blue jeans at some point. So, you know, how that works, I don't know. You probably do. How does a deer's vision compare to that of a human's? Because a lot of times too, I'm walking around and I look at my hunting, you know, my setup, like I'm looking at my tree stand setup and I'm going, man, I don't know how in the world that worked, because it's plain as day to me that I'm there. And then other times, I mean, you know, I'm like really excited about it. I got it all brushed in and it's just a, you know, my tree stand's just a little hole in the limbs, and it just feels like you can get away with anything. So first, to start things off, tell us a little bit about how a deer's vision compares to our vision.
It's quite a bit different, and we're still learning quite a bit about it. I started my work on deer vision in the early 2000s, and we continue it today. And we've had multiple students doing this research, and we're investigating some really cool avenues now. But if we just go to the basic anatomy of the deer eye, which is where we did a lot of our early work, it's a lot different. First of all, they've got this really big eye, so this globe that if you take it out of the deer's head, it's much larger than the human eye, and it's designed to capture the maximum amount of light. Paired with that, they've got this horizontal slit pupil, so our pupil's round during really bright conditions. It clamps down into a little circle. With a deer eye, their pupil, it can open, the size of their pupil can open larger than the size of our entire eye. So that
Wow.
means they're bringing in maximum photons of light. And when it's really bright conditions, it can clamp down to just little tiny pinpricks so that it protects their light sensitive retina. And so that light coming in, they maximize that. They've got this specialized lens that focuses light on their retina. Those rods and cones accept as much light as possible. And then what doesn't get picked up for them to perceive the first time gets bounced back. We've all seen the eye shine a deer, right? Hopefully you
Right.
haven't been poaching or anything, but even in your headlights, you've seen the eye shine a deer. And that reflective structure is called tapetum lucidum. And what that does, it's like foil. You can actually peel it off the back of the retina of the deer eye when you're dissecting them. And that foil, essentially, that natural foil, bounces light back to the rods and cones so they have a second chance to absorb light. And so, long story short, on that basic anatomy is the deer is so much more adept at capturing light than we are. Think about if you're in the woods, you've got your stand set up, you turn your headlamp off. It takes a little while for your eyes to adjust, and you start to say, "Man, I'm like the ultimate predator. I can see out here in the dark." Well, the deer can likely see multiple times better in those dark conditions or at dawn and dusk than us. And so, first of all, capturing light is their go-to. They're designed to see better at night, better at dawn and dusk when they're moving quite a bit. As we well know, we try to capture them, going from feeding to bedding areas at those dawn and dusk periods. Some other differences: deer can see in the UV spectrum. So we've got a yellow filter in our lens, and that filters out a lot of UV light because we're long-lived relative to deer, and we need our retina to be protected from those UV rays. Deer have a perfectly clear lens, and so that they can see more UV light. When's UV light available? Dawn and dusk, when they're most active. And so when they're moving and we're trying to intercept them, they're able to perceive things much better than us when those UV light attributes of the environment are most high. Now, there is a big difference in that we're trichromats, so we can see short, medium, and long wavelengths. Those long wavelengths are oranges and reds. Deer lack that third photopigment, and we've done some anatomical research to understand where in the deer retina and what cones they have, and we can understand that they can see green best. So those mid wavelengths, they can see those lower wavelengths, blues, they can see browns, yellows, but at orange and red, their perception of color falls off. Obviously, they can still see objects that are those colors, but it's more in the more grayscale, I guess is what I would say. And so that blaze orange that we wear, at least from a color perception, the tone of color, it doesn't appear as orange to them. It probably appears more yellowish brown. But if it's got a lot of UV brighteners in it, if it's the consistency of a starched envelope or whatever you want to say, it's going to stand out. It's going to have a lot of sheen to it, which is why I like my vest to be a little crustier, and
Yeah,
I
a little
still have
worn.
some from like elementary school. I guess I was a big boy. They still fit me, but they're a little worn, let's just say.
Yeah, that's funny. And you kind of touched on it a little bit there. I'm guilty. I'll wear my vest or my hat to my stand and I'll put it in the pack and put my camo hat on. Are there any other misconceptions or common misconceptions that hunters have about deer and how they see?
Yeah, I think some people think the deer can't see any level of detail. They think that, we're a big blob to them. But in reality, they can see levels of detail, and we study that through different systems. It's just that they probably wouldn't pass a driving test, let's say, to get their driving license. They probably have 20/100 vision or in that neighborhood. What that means is that what we can see from all the way back at 100 feet, deer has to be about 20 feet to see it at the same level of detail. And so we can scale that up to your bow stand. What you see at 100 yards, a deer has to be more within bow range to be able to make out that level of detail. So they're still seeing, let's say, branches, leaves, your arm moving, but they don't see the level of detail. They don't see the hair on your arm or, the Gucci gloves that you guys might wear out in the stand or whatever it may be. They don't see the level of detail that we do, but they're certainly picking up on those larger attributes of their visual field.
Funny that you bring up the distance, because that's one of the things I've always noticed is like kind of the scenario I'll play out is I've been bow hunting, for example, and I've had a deer within 20 yards and I've moved my wrist, and the deer like keys in on me immediately. Whereas I've had deer out in a field and I'm 100 yards or more away. And honestly, if you just kind of take it slow and walks, and if you'll just walk directly at them a lot of times, if you just don't go any doing anything crazy, a lot of times they can tell something's happening out there, but they'll just wait. They don't know what it is. And so that
Yeah.
makes a lot of sense based on what you're saying is that they just don't have that attention to detail at further distances.
They may think, "Hey, it's that coyote again, that 30-pound or less little slug that I'm going to just stomp into the ground if he comes up to me." And especially watching deer out west, videos of deer out west folks can see on YouTube. It's like, yeah, coyotes are over there. They're not bothering us. But if they get really close or they get close to our fawns, then we're going to get excited. But it's something but it's probably not something we need to worry about at that distance.
You mentioned
Makes
how
sense.
well they can see in low light too. Now, of course, we're always thinking dawn and dusk. Those are the time periods where we probably do most of our hunting and see most of our deer. What about pitch black dark? Is there any, and I think more about like ingress and egress from a stand, like
I was about to say,
does
Joe,
it benefit you?
you're not supposed to be hunting deer at night. Now you know
Well, you know, like
that,
I know, I mean, you know, I've got a little
right?
six-year-old that I'm getting out there a good bit now, and it'll be past legal shooting light a lot of times. And I like to let things get good and dark before we get out of the stand. You know, say, hey, look, we're gonna wait till it's totally dark. And he's like, well, we can't hunt anymore. Why can't we get down now? And I'd like to wait until it's just pitch black dark. Am I wasting my time there, Gino?
Yeah, I think it helps. But one thing that can kind of confound that is that they know something's there when you're walking out. They're still hearing you, they're smelling you, they're sensing you, and they can't evaluate it well with vision. And so they may not know what it is unless they absolutely smell you. They're going to know it's something predator-like, and it's going to be a deterrent for them, whether that session, next session, whatever it may be. And sometimes if you're hunting, like, you know, sometimes I hunt in more suburban areas and they're used to people when they know what it is. And like you said, even out in the field, a farmer in a field, if they know what it is or there's this common activity, sometimes it's better for them to almost know what you are, the cadence of your steps, getting out of there, that you're not a threat to them. But in pitch black conditions, they can't see if they don't have light to work with. Now, if we're talking about, you know, kind of twilight, if we're talking about half and full moon, even quarter crescent moons, they have photons of light that they can work with. They can see. Now, it's certainly less detail. There's no color associated with it in darkness, but they can certainly make out what's going on. Likely that you're some sort of a predator, or, you know, you're certainly not that armadillo scooting along. You're something bigger and more of a threat.
Yeah, I do agree with you though, Joe. I was busting you there a little bit, but I feel the same way. And kind of to Gino's point, sometimes I feel like if I get down, the deer doesn't see me, and I'm scurrying away, and he hears me, he might not know that it was me getting in and out of that shooting house. Instead of him seeing me, I feel like it makes me feel
Right.
better anyways. I don't know whether
Right.
that
A little more
matters or
confident.
not, but
I'll
yeah,
tell
for
you though,
sure.
guys, sometimes, like, I know in the coming weeks, there's some areas that I hunt on public land that are just going to be raining acorns. And I don't know that. And they're far back until I get in there and I'm ready. I don't even go in to scout. I just want to get in there and hunt when it's hot. And when the acorns are hot, that is. And I'll go in full white light on my headlamp. And if I'm not seeing deer in my headlamp, I'm thinking this isn't going to be a good hunt. I'm already all the way in here. Now
Right.
they know I'm not a predator. I'm not a raccoon. I'm something big and different. But those deer don't interact with people a lot of the time because it's, you know, deep national forest. They know something's there. They're happy to see where I'm at, know where I'm at, watch me walk by, sometimes almost in bow range. I'll go get set up and shoot some of them same deer when it comes light, because just like those coyotes in the field in out west, they know where I'm at. I'm not a threat to them. They can evade me if they need to. And I think that's where we think about deer vision in the context of their entire security system. Again, their sense of smell, their hearing, which is quite good, and vision's part of that. But if something trips that security trigger, they're going to take off and go to cover and put some ground between you. But they don't want to expend that energy if they don't need to, if they don't have it identified as a known threat.
Talking about that just a little bit, you mentioned walking in there with the white light. Does the red light make that any better, or do you feel like it's going to be less suspicious?
Yeah, I can say a red light really does help. And I know from experience, my 5 years working for USDA Wildlife Services, I did a lot of deer removal in urban areas. So think about downtown Philadelphia, where we were sharpshooting deer where safe. And our go-to was identifying where deer were with thermal imagery. And then to verify that we had safe shooting, we'd go to the red light. And we shot thousands of deer under red light, and they're much calmer. In fact, we've installed red lighting in our captive deer research facility. So when we move deer at night, they're just calmer. It's less intense, and they can't see that red color. And it just keeps them more calm as if in moonlight conditions.
Makes cool. That's very cool. Makes sense. You mentioned how big the deer's eye is and how much he can see, especially us bow hunters. I think everybody's seen the deer walks in and totally parallel to you, and she's got her or he's got his head totally down, and you think you're good. And man, as soon as you make anything, you are busted. So I know their peripheral vision is very, very good, but what's the range of the deer's peripheral vision? How wide is their field of view?
Yeah, so we've got about 180, and you think about we've got to turn our heads constantly. You're in the stand. I'm sort of like I'm gonna look around, but I'm starting to strain my eyes, and as the day goes on, I'm turning my head more and more to look around. And that deer doesn't have to do it. They've got upwards of 300 degrees,
Wow.
and so they've got these
Wow.
really wide set eyes coupled with their big eyes, and they generally don't have to move their head. Especially when they work with their buddies, you'll see them bed it together, often orient it differently so that they can cover the entire horizon and know if something trips that security system.
Speaking of that too, like Butch mentioned, getting busted. I think we've all done that, and I've also just reminded of all the days bow hunting when that deer. They kind of sense something's a little up, and
They do the head
they'll put
nod.
their head down like they're fixing to eat, and then jerk it right back up and look at you. And
Gotcha.
that got me quite a few times as a young bow hunter, and then over the years I've learned. So is the best bet there then to just if you can see their eyes, they can see you. You have to wait till there's some type of physical obstruction, or they're looking directly the other way, and you're in that 60 degrees that they can't see.
Yeah, and even the looking the other way, it still gets me. I'll be like, all right, I'm gonna raise up, and they nail you, right?
Yeah.
And they've got that good 300 degrees of vision. So I try to use an obstruction myself, which is often difficult. But with today's bows with higher let off, it helps a little bit before they kind of get close and in a window, you can find more objects to put between you, get your gun in place. Yeah, so and when they put their head down to feed, they've got this mechanism called cyclovergence where their eye goes level. It's kind of like a gyroscope on the bottom of a helicopter when,
Oh, wow.
they're doing a search for somebody. They can bank and that camera is still level. And
Oh,
the deer
wow.
has the same thing in their eye. So they're like, this sucker, I'm going to put my head down. Oh, I still got you.
Yeah, I saw you.
That's wild.
I saw you
What
reach for that bow.
a cool. So let's talk about the research a little bit there. Kind of what methods do you guys use to study and understand how deer see? Kind of what does that look like at your facility?
Yeah, we've got a range of things, and also we work with deer in the wild as well, but we do basic anatomy research. So where I mentioned earlier, we dissect the eye, looking at its layers microscopically. Some of the work that I did for my doctoral degree was to use immunohistochemistry, and that's a big word, and I didn't know what the heck it meant at the time, but essentially I followed recipes to use antibody labeling of the cone cells in the deer eye. And so, long story short, once you label them and look under a fluorescent microscope, it just looks like the stars in the sky. And I could survey across their retina, counting the cells, and I could tell whether they were short wavelength or medium wavelength cells. And I was able to map the deer retina to tell where those concentrations of cones were. And so through that anatomical research, we're able to identify that they had a horizontal streak. And so we've got an optic fovea where we've got a really high concentration of cone cells in a pinpoint area. And that's why we have to move our eye across a page to read. But a deer's got this wide streak of concentrated cones. So like I said, they can keep their head still and still see on the horizon without moving their head. Their eye is also tuned to that. So we can also compare them to other species. What's the size of their lens? What's the size of these different components of their eye? That's where the anatomical research gets us. It allows us kind of coarse interpretation of how deer probably see versus mice and, birds of prey, humans, large cats, etc. That's where the anatomical research gets us. Next, we go to working with deer and often sedating them and using electrophysiology. And so what that means is we bring the deer in our captive facility, sedate them so they're asleep like when you're at the dentist, and then we expose their visual system to different stimuli. It can be colors, it can be movement, so we understand how they perceive movement, and or wavelengths of color that are moving in different ways. patterning, etc. And we monitor their brain waves so that we understand what is exciting their brain of these different stimuli that we're giving them. So think, red colors, yellow, green, etc. And then we can pulse it at different frequencies and understand how, when we've done studies like this, not that I've done studies on humans, by the way, I don't have permission to do that, but we know other folks have and published that information, and we can compare it versus deer. And we work with the suite of professionals here at UGA and other places, but we work with people from the psychology department, vet medicine, human medicine, because they've got these techniques worked out, and we can bring them in, or we can go to their facility and learn these techniques and work with them to understand how deer compare to other species. Another model that we use is behavioral trials. And I have to say, it's one of my least favorite because the other two are slam dunks. We can kill a deer out in the wild that would have been killed anyway, take its eyes, do these anatomical studies. We can sedate them with drugs. They've got no choice. We carry them into our laboratory facility and we can work with them, then send them back out to their paddock. But when we want that deer to behaviorally tell us, like a 2-year-old, what they can see, it can be a nightmare scenario. And I've raised fawns from the bottle, taken them from their mom at 3 days old. I've done it. My students have done it. And I'm here to tell you, I love the white-tailed deer, but they're dumb as bricks. They're instinctual. They have very strong instinct, but the cognition, the processing of information is not very high. And so we try to train them to identify targets to get a treat. Like some of their favorite treats are prunes and beets and carrots. And like each individual will have different preferences. And okay, Betsy, here's your treat. You saw the target. Now do it again. And we beat our heads into the wall to get them over 60, 70% success on that. But
Wow.
there are certain deer at our facility, and we've had generations of them that are willing to work with us. And so the animals that we tend to use for those studies, we've bottle raised from a couple days old. They're human accommodated. They think that they're humans too. And we can bring them into a stall and we can use apparatuses that automatically generate targets for them to see and respond to, and also record their responses so that when they walk down an aisle that they've chosen that they think the right target's at, it's automatically recorded. And so we can do hundreds and thousands of trials with the deer interacting with the apparatus on its own. And so we've only had a select number of deer through the years that are willing to work with us on that and be trained to a target. Then we're able to change those targets and make them more difficult. So let me just be a little more clear on that. When you go to the eye doctor and they say, read down this chart, obviously deer can't read letters, but they can identify a target, a pattern, a striped pattern. And if we make that pattern more intricate with smaller lines, or it can be circles that are more intricate, the deer identifies that as its target. And then as we make it harder to tell, their response rate, their positive response rate goes down. They get it wrong more and more. And so over time, once they go below the threshold of it's just mere chance, we say they're not seeing that target anymore. And so we've used that to identify patterns and colors that they respond to, and then compare it to our electrophysical work and our anatomical work to kind of verify across those three branches, what do we think deer can see?
That's really interesting because, to go back to what you said about deer not having the cognition, they're instinctual. I think we've all considered that. We're like, if they were that smart, they wouldn't walk out into this field with that big shooting house over there last year, like the first time you ever saw a deer die in front of you, they'd go, never going here again. This was terrible. So they don't have that part figured out. But like you said, how do they know you're there sometimes? And it's those instincts. They pick up those you're an odd
Anomaly.
pattern
Yeah, you're
for
anomaly.
this section of woods I see every single day or every other day for my whole life. That does make a lot of sense. My next question, you were talking about the what do you call it, cyclovergence?
That's right, yes.
Cyclovergence. That's really interesting to me because I think we've all experienced that deer with the head down that picks up your movement. I'll tell you a little secret. Every hunter in Alabama thinks that they are better than all the other hunters in the rest of the country. I mean, this is just the way it is. I mean, we know that we are master woodsmen, you know, no one else can compare. And a couple years ago, I was out in Montana. We were hunting antelope, and I was hunting with a guy out there, a buddy of mine who's been hunting Montana, you know, for decades. And there were some antelope out there. They were about 900 yards away, 1,000 yards away or so, and they were sitting on the side of a ridge, and we were on that same side of that ridge. And if we knew that if we could get on the other side of that ridge and put that ridge in between us and the antelope, we could cut the distance and get up there and make a shot. And you know, Alan, the guy I was hunting with, I said, man, let's just sneak down that draw and get across. They're not gonna see us. They're 1,000 yards away. And he looked at me like, oh no, they'll see us. And I was like, there's no way they're gonna see us. We're 1,000 yards away. He's like, you wanna try it? I was like, yeah. I mean, well, no problem.
I
We
got
took
this.
three steps and the whole entire herd stood up and immediately focused on us, you know. And I couldn't believe it, but you know, after that hunt and learning about antelope, from what I read, their vision is like an 8x binocular. I mean, like something like 8x magnification, at least from what the internet says. I believe it after seeing how they pinpointed us trying to, you know, creep across that ridge. That was very surprising to me. Has there been anything that you've learned about the whitetail's eye that's been very surprising for you through all this research?
I think that's a good example, and I think it's that perception of movement. And I think it, like I'm envisioning you and your friend, you're kind of like ants crawling across a page, like or across your picnic table. You don't care what kind of ant it is. It could be a fire ant or, you know, any kind of ant, black ant. But you don't want that ant on your table. You can't see how many legs it has, but you know it shouldn't be there. And that's what I think it is that they're picking up on. And what we've learned is, you know, whereas we can see it 60 hertz of movement, deer can see it probably over 100 hertz. That movement perception, what that means is not only can they pick up on movement better, you know, us moving our bow arm, whatever it may be, they can also run through intricate environments much faster. And because they can perceive what's coming at them, and they can juke from that branch or whatever it may be. And so think about, for an animal that has to just survive, they don't care if it's a coyote, wolf, bobcat, or Joe Hunter. They just need to respond to it. And they don't care if you have Sitka or First Light on.
They just know they don't want to tangle with something that's not supposed to be there.
So I
Yeah, that
think it's
makes
that
sense.
movement perception, which it bothers me because it's like, I think we win in so many fronts on their vision. You know, we've got better color vision, we can see more detail, we've got better acuity, and they're going to win every time on the movement. And it makes it so hard to stalk a deer and to be high enough to be out of that visual range and to hide your movements even in a blind, even in a four-walled blind. And so I just have a lot of appreciation for their ability to pick up on movement.
Yeah,
Is
absolutely. And that's why we keep going back. It's so much fun. You never can figure them out, it seems like.
You know, and speaking of that movement, I mean, I can remember being my first memories, you know, hunting. We'd be sitting still, and you know, back then there, you know, camo wasn't really as much of a thing. It was just kind of you'd have on some OD green, maybe some woodland, you know, leftover army surplus type stuff. But I can remember my godfather telling me when a deer would, you know, be in, when we could see the deer, he'd say, just move really painfully slow. Like, you know, like he would tell me, you know, if you want to turn your head to the left and look and see what's over to the left, turn your head to the left, but do it as slow as you can possibly do it. And that's really served me well over the year. Is that good advice? Is it just about, if you're gonna move, is it about moving painfully slow? Can they still pick that up?
I agree, and I use the same technique, just, you know, imperceptibly slow, so that you are blending into your background. And especially if you've got just the slightest breeze or anything, things are moving, but just very slowly. And so, I mean, if a deer is looking right at me, of course I don't want to move, but if they're kind of doing their thing, I'm just going to move slow and just try to blend in with my surroundings. I agree. I think it's great for moving your head. I've yet to really find where it works, where I'm trying to really slip in on them, though, that I can ever move. slow enough,
Slow enough.
especially
That's
when it's
right.
paired with any crunch
Any
or any
sound, yeah.
smell. You can forget it.
Yeah, or multiple deer for that matter.
Yeah,
Yeah.
right.
You mentioned, along with the laboratory research that you guys do there at the facility, you mentioned some field research. What do you guys do out in the field that's different from what you do in the laboratory? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we started to look at, we've got a lot of studies where we put GPS collars on deer, and it's usually to study their movements relative to different habitat types, disease, population management. But we generate millions of points of deer movements across the country, and we've started to push that information into this model of studying how deer move relative to their vision. And so, depending on the time of day, the vegetation they're moving through, we pair that movement information with how we think they're perceiving the environment at that particular time period. And so my recently graduated student, Blaise Newman, she did a study using bucks that we had collared in Central Florida in a cattle ranching environment where vegetation was pretty limited to wetlands, some woodland forest, open pastures, and it was really interesting to see how those bucks moved, especially by the way they bed a lot during the day, and much of this research was done during the summertime, and how they decided to move from their bedding to feeding areas during those crepuscular times, dawn and dusk, really seemed to be dictated by what they can see to have the advantage to get the drop on predators and hunters during the early season that they're moving during hunting season. So I think it's our first step, and we're hoping to apply it to more systems, especially systems that are more forested, more intricate. But we're starting to get to that kind of fourth tier of understanding how deer vision relates to their behavior.
That's really interesting because I mean that kind of lends into practical applications for hunting. I mean, if I go back to turkeys a lot, but you'll hear a lot of old timers, they'll say certain things. They're like, "Hey, when it's raining, those turkeys are going to get out in an open field. They don't like the water on their feathers, and they don't like to be
Right.
brushing up against all that wet stuff." And a lot of that stuff's true. I mean, you don't even have to have research to know. Like they just listen to what they've seen it over their whole lifetime. They've just connected the dots.
Historical research.
Yeah, with some of that tagging
Right.
or radio collar radio, I assume it's radio telemetry, but with the collar studies that you're talking about, is it going to change? Has it changed the way you hunt at all?
A little bit. I like to claim that it doesn't. But it makes me think, and it also verifies some of what I see, some of the contours I see deer using, also the timing. You brought up weather with turkeys, but I was just looking at the weather before we started to talk, and this hurricane coming through, and I'm looking, all right, it's going to drive through Friday, and Friday evening looks like a possibility. Saturday morning will be quite good. Because for deer movement, because they hunker down during these big events, whether it's a polar vortex where we see big snow and cold temperatures. And the reason that I'm so intrigued by seeing our GPS collar movements correlate with that information is because we've run trail cameras for research for so long, and we see the same thing. Even deer on a bait site, they're coming, they're coming, they're coming to the bait. Then you get a weather event, everything shuts down, especially in the north. When we'd see a really strong snow event, deer movements would shut down. Literally, when that last snowflake falls, the deer are back on the bait. And now we see that pairing with our GPS collar data, which can be quite fine. I mean, we can get deer locations. So this is where the collar's collecting information from the satellites and then uploading to the satellites those locations. So we can get them sometimes almost real time when we need them. We can see deer movements by the minute if we want to. Now that costs a lot of money and burns a lot of battery. But if we want to really up locations, we can do that. And when we have big events like that, we sometimes do it. In fact, we've got a study right now in the Delta of Louisiana on the Mississippi because we want to understand how deer movements relate to water inundation. And so as the Mississippi rises, how is it affecting deer use of ag fields, the bacher area between the river and the levee? And so, yeah, we're starting to learn more and more about deer movements that I think is quite intriguing for hunters as well. And it's intriguing for me. Now, it's not like I'm looking and saying, hey, I don't hunt on a lot of these areas that we research, but I'm just trying to pick up on those big trends. And that's what we describe in our research papers. I mean, a lot of times we've got a real strong purpose that we're trying to understand disease or a management technique, but we also describe generally more of what we're learning about deer movement ecology as it relates to their physiology and their behavior.
All right, folks, we're going to be right back. Y'all take a minute and check out some of our sponsors. Farm Credit of Northwest Florida. Farm Credit of Northwest Florida has over a century of experience providing financing for people who live, work, or play in the country. Farm Credit is here to help you make your dream of country living a reality. Their unique cooperative structure allows them to return some of their profits back to their borrowers. This patronage distribution effectively lowers a borrower's rate. To get started with your first or next land purchase, give them a call at 855-GO-RURAL or visit them at www.gorural.net. Texas Hunter. Since 1954, Texas Hunter Products has produced the best engineered and finest quality feeders and hunting blinds in the industry. The Texas Hunter brand has become synonymous with quality and durability. By sticking to premium standards, the company delivers tough, long-lasting products that meet the real-life needs of anglers and hunters across America. Their fish feeders, deer feeders, hunting blinds, and outdoor accessories are among the highest rated in the industry. You can trust that your purchase from Texas Hunter Products will meet your needs for generations to come. To learn more, visit texashunter.com. Bucks Island Marine. At bucksisland.com, you can check out the full list of inventory from new and used bass, pontoon, and bow rider style boats, new and used motors, as well as kayaks. They love trade-ins, which provides a steady stream of used boats, and they can rig your boat at their 18-bay service department or ship your new motor anywhere in the United States. They provide boat service on all kinds of boats, even if they weren't purchased from Bucks. They have factory-trained and certified technicians, so visit them at 4500 Highway 77 in Southside, Alabama, or give them a call at 256-442-2588. You know, getting back to, you mentioned, well, kind of where we left off with the vision aspect was the background contrast, you know, blending in with your background, that movement, they can pick up that movement so well with what's going on in the background. When you start to think about the way a deer sees, in order of importance, what does the research suggest is like the most critical factors for camouflage? Like, is it number one, you know, your background and your breakup, and then color and pattern of your actual, your clothing and that type of thing? Because I know I spend a lot of time, at least when I'm hunting with a bow and trying to get close, I spend a lot of time thinking about, okay, this is a spot I'm going to be sitting in the afternoon. Where's the sun going to be? Am I going to be staring into the sun? Are the deer going to, if the deer look my way, are they going to be looking into the sun? Do I have limbs behind me, or am I backlit, you know, with the sky? There's a lot of that I take into account. What do you feel like is the most important thing to take into account?
Yeah, I think both from research and experience, having that backdrop is most important. And there's two really big reasons for that. First, this movement that we've talked about. And so if you've got a solid wall behind you, solid and with some texture, you know, different trees, really dense vegetation, you're just going to be part of that. It's so intricate that they're not going to be able to pick up your movement as much, especially if you've got a bunch of saplings behind you that are just swaying, right? There's movement there in the environment already. And so breaking up your outline to prevent their perception of movement is really important. Another reason that having that backdrop is so important is because they've got poorer depth perception. And that's because their eyes are wide set. You and I, we've got this binocular vision. Both eyes are talking. They're not talking to each other. The brain's interpreting that information. But we're sending these two points of information back to our brain. And it's processing. It's that central processing unit to say, okay, you know, these things are picking up on nuances. These two different eyes are picking up on nuances. So we can perceive depth better. With their eyes being wide set, there's not as much information that's in concert from their eyes going to their central nervous system. And so that lack of depth perception allows us to be more like Flat Stanley. You know, elementary kids used to take Flat Stanley around and get their picture taken with them all around the world, et cetera. We're more like that cardboard cutout. You're just another part of that tree, that big old tree that you're against. Now, if you're in a tripod stand in the middle of Texas and you're backlit by the blue sky, everything you do, all your movement, and that you're not something natural in the environment, it's going to be easily perceived by the deer. But if you're in that tripod in the scrub and you've got this intricate background, especially if you've got a pattern that doesn't make you stand out against that background. I think one of the things that we do most is we wear camouflage. I'm not going to like endorse or go against any certain camouflage company, but the pattern isn't as important as how that pattern relates to what's behind you and the texture of your fabric. Does it have a sheen? Does it have UV brighteners? I think those things are what cause clothing in general to stand out. And some of the things that we do, like those of us that are researchers, but also have an interest in hunting, and our eyes are far different than deer. But besides my setup, I want to look at how my camo looks in the woods, especially just that fabric. And I'll put my camo up and stand back and move further back and back again, look from different angles, look at different times of day. My neighbors think I'm a little weird when I do that in my backyard, but I'm learning about, when is it, if this sun's hitting me, if the sun's going down, how does that pattern, how does that texture of fabric look? And I've culled some things from my wardrobe, and my wardrobe's not the most expensive or pretty, and it hurts me, but some things just don't make the cut anymore.
Yep, that's right. And yeah, just kind of to your point there. I mean, what we use here in the Southeast in the Piney Woods is going to be a little different than, the guys in Colorado. But if I'm understanding you correctly, your backdrop is the most important. Say early season archery here, there's going to be a lot more green in the woods, going to be a lot more leaves. So you need to match your camo with the background regardless of your environment.
Yeah, I think so. And, if I'm in the right environment and I'm well concealed, let's say in a natural blind with some good backstop, I'll be in my tuxedo. It doesn't matter. I'll be really dressed for the affair.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with that. Like, Butch and I both have hung many tree stands together and walked past a bunch more that we either were a part of hanging or didn't hang. And you can just tell when they're not going to be able to see you in there, because it's almost like you got some limbs or maybe they're underneath you that kind of stick out in front of you, and then you've got the limbs of the trees that are behind you, and you're just in this little
Little
cocoon,
nest.
you know. And it's deadly for sure. Back to what Butch is saying though, like with color, that's always been the one thing that is kind of Butch mentioned taking his blaze orange hat off, and I'm that way too. I'm like I spend all this effort to get close and get myself tucked in there, and I'm like I just don't. Once I get out, once I get off the ground, I'm like I just don't want this orange hat on, Like it just makes me not lose confidence. But how important is it to match your the color of your camo to the season? We always see that we see the early season patterns and the late season patterns and that type of thing. Like, is it more about the color of the camouflage or more about just not being a green blob in a sea of gray?
I think it's more about breaking up your outline, not just with that background, but also, I've had plenty of experiences now, not only looking at my own camo, but trying to look at my buddies from afar and things like that. And those that really, really stand out are folks that like to wear everything that's the same small, intricate pattern. They end up looking like a blob. And so, think of the traditional jail uniform, the one with the black and white stripes. If you're up close, you see the black and white stripes. And these are same visual acuity gratings that we use to test deer, actually, test their vision. If say that jailbird has escaped and they're running across the field outside the jailhouse, as they get away from you, that black and white eventually merges to gray. It becomes a gray blob. You don't see the black and white pattern anymore. And that's what happens to those really intricate camo patterns. So for me, what I wanted, like, remember Jim Zumbo always used to wear like a vest when he hunted? I think he was Field & Stream or Outdoor Life. I can't remember. Big muley hunter. I really like a vest, to be honest with you. It's quite dapper to begin with and has a lot of pockets, But even if you have whatever, pick your finest camo and you put an orange vest over it, And that orange vest doesn't have really high sheen. It's not really, really bright. I mean, I know that we have to meet our fluorescent requirements as hunters, but it doesn't have to be super bright and shiny and brand new. That orange vest can actually help to break up your outline because to the deer, it doesn't look orange because they can't see orange. It looks brighter. And if you're looking up at your buddy in the tree stand, what you're seeing is, yeah, you're seeing branches, leaves, camo, tree, sky. You're always seeing sky oftentimes, unless you're on a mountainside. And so I think having some bright components, some openings, having, your shirt be different than your pants is more important than the camo pattern. I think about one of the finest tree stands that we ever had as a family on our mountain in Bradford County, Pennsylvania. Our mountain was as steep as this, almost 45 degrees probably. And often the deer would travel below our stand. That stand had no backdrop in its own, but the mountain behind us, with all the oak leaves, all the branches, all the different trees, that broke up our pattern. So even
Right.
though technically we were skylined, we had this intricate pattern behind us, and deer would rarely pick us up. I shot my first deer there. My brother shot his first deer there. We shot dozens of deer from that stand, and rarely were we picked out because we had good backstop. And oftentimes we did wear, like sometimes we wore complete orange suits, but sometimes we had, different pants, different shirts, an orange vest, orange cap. We didn't worry about it, but we often had stuff that wasn't as bright.
When I turkey hunt, I feel completely naked if I don't have on at least a leafy, I call it a leafy suit top. I don't wear it in my pants, but like most of my movement's going to occur in my torso and up, around my head. And I feel a lot of confidence in that leafy suit. I've had turkeys get incredibly close, and not pick me up. Whereas, a lot of times if I'm in a deer stand, and a turkey comes walking through the woods, they're like, I mean, the gig is up immediately. They immediately key in on you. Is that is that a psychosomatic thing where I just think I'm doing better, or is more 3D texture gonna really help in a camouflage scenario?
I think both for turkeys and deer, breaking up your outline. And
Yeah.
if I really wanted to have the best of the best leafy camo, it'd probably be more like, those when you're on a green screen, people are wearing all the balls all over them. It'd be really big things,
Yeah.
Really, I would love to have big old wings that were like leaves. Of course, I'm not going to dress like that,
Yeah.
but something that makes you not look like a boxy human form or a
Yeah.
crouched predator is really what you're looking for. And so, yeah, I think if I was to choose one part of my body to put a leafy camo on, it would be my head. Because I think, especially the bill of a cap, when you turn, is quite a profile. And oftentimes we're caught with our head turned, and our head just seems to stick out, especially if we're moving left and right. I think that's what profiles us most. I don't think it's the core of our body.
Yeah, that's funny you say that. Right whenever Joe and I were kind of going over the outline here, we were talking about, I forget who it was just recently. I was talking about, and somebody was like, yeah, the bill of the hat is the kiss of death. I was like, I'd never really thought about that before, but it makes sense.
Well, plus you
Kind
can
of.
wear those really short-billed old school bow hunter caps,
Yeah, you
And
can make them too. I'm here to tell you, my wife loves the one where I cut the bill down. It's like, do you have to wear that in public? You look ridiculous.
Well, I think we've touched on a couple of these things here as far as stand placement and kind of how to be mindful of not being, in direct sunlight and some different things like that to be mindful of whenever you're setting up your lock on or a tree stand or a blind. What are some other things that we can do? Kind of what's your take on, the elevation of your stand, and what are some other things that hunters can be mindful of, trying to get a harvest?
Yeah, I think trying to get out of their field of view, and I'm not saying folks need to climb 50 feet, but with the cyclovergence putting their head down, their eyes always leveling out, they definitely look up. I mean, deer evolved with predators from above, including mountain lions, bobcats even today. If something's going to jump out of a tree and bite your throat, you're going to look up sometimes. And so I think getting high enough relative to where you're at, thinking about what direction deer are going to come from so that you're not profiled. Because if you're hanging off the side of the tree and your skyline behind you, you're going to be picked out versus if you're on a big old tree that's almost as wide as you. And I know we can only get our climbers and some of our lock-ons on a tree of a certain width, but the wider the tree, the better. I generally don't want to be in a skinny tree unless I'm going to get high enough and be up there where I've got a nice backdrop of leaves, branches, etc. I like the sun behind me because deer, their eyes are acclimated generally if you're in a woodland environment to more of a muted sunlight environment. They're not looking directly at the sun. If they have to look into it, it's going to overwhelm their system because it takes a while for their eyes to adjust to that light. So those are some of the big things that I'm thinking about. If I'm, say, using a hang-on stand and I'm putting sticks on the tree, I want to tuck those straps in. Or if I've got a climber, I don't want my straps hanging and moving in the breeze. If it's something a couple inches wide, in bow distance, those deer are going to pick up on that movement. And so just reducing as much movement as possible, not leaving artificial things down on the ground below your tree.
Definitely done that, unfortunately.
Yeah. Makes me feel
Forgot.
good. I'm doing some things right. I'm always
Yeah.
mindful of like my pack pull-up string. I like tuck it in and make sure
Yeah,
it's not
right.
hanging down
Oh,
and
yeah.
things like that.
Yeah, you just, I mean, ultimately you try to make it
Minimalize.
like you're not there, right? I mean, I think that all that stuff's relevant. I really pay a lot of attention to the direction of the sun. One, because I don't want to look into the sun all morning or all afternoon myself, but two, it just seems like when you've got the sun at your back, it really does help. You know, what about when you're talking about wind and movement, and you got a lot of vegetation moving around you? You know, you were saying those collar studies have shown you that when there's a big weather event, those deer hunker down. I, as a kid, was always told like, you know, it's going to be super windy today. We're not going to go hunting. The deer don't move when it's super, super windy. You know, those hard northern 25-mile-an-hour fronts coming through. Last few years, I've killed several bucks actually hunting on those exact days, but I kind of changed my strategy. I use those days to get really close to deer where I feel like they might be bedded, or even do a still hunt
Bump them.
where I'm maybe I kind of bump them out of their bed because I feel like I can get closer, I can get away with more movement. And I've had some good success on that. Going back to the collar studies, you mentioned that they hunker down. Do they still move a little bit? It's just more in a tighter area, or do they really truly just not move at all?
Yeah, it's more in a tighter area, especially if they're in dense cover. You know, they feel comfortable. So we'll see kind of. It's hard for us to tell exactly because there's air associated with the collars, just like your
Sure.
cell phone location. So we can say they're in a concentrated area. We can't say necessarily if they're getting up and doing a little feeding right around them, but we can tell that they're certainly in a house-sized area or, you know, your bedroom area, maybe a really big palatial
Wow.
bedroom, and just keeping their movements concentrated. We've yet to show a relationship though between. And j probably just because of the fineness of our data, a relationship between the wind and their movements. And so, you know, personally, I've seen deer move just fine during really windy days, especially if they're coming to a concentrated food source and they're bedded nearby. They're just happy to come out and be out in that wind. I will say their vigilance goes up, which means that they're looking more, they're listening
High
more.
alert.
They may take 10 minutes before they take another bite of something, but they're still going to come out and move.
Well, Gina, I've learned a lot from what you said today. I've confirmed some things that I thought were true, and it's given me some thoughts on how I'm going to change up a few things with regards to not only how I camouflage myself, but also how I move. You know, and the amount of movement that I feel like I'm comfortable with in the stand. You know, you've dedicated your career to study a deer and deer ecology. A lot of folks that listen to this podcast are parents of young people who are thinking about what career path to take, or maybe they're young people themselves that are trying to figure out a way to, like we said at the beginning of the show, it's a really awesome thing when you're able to combine something that you're passionate about and truly intrinsically interested in and then turn that into a job, into a career, something that, you know, you can make a living doing. Butch and I have both been able to do it. It's very empowering. You've been able to do it as well. What advice do you have for young people that might want to be in, you know, maybe interested in getting into any of the natural resource fields, maybe following a path similar to your own, or just want to go look for more information about the different types of career paths that are out there.
Yeah, guys, I have to say it's a pretty darn good gig. It served me well, and I love talking about deer and wildlife in general. And we've got a lot of passionate students here, and so I'm at the Warnell School of Forestry and Natural Resources at University of Georgia, and we've got forestry, wildlife science, we've got fisheries, water resources, parks and recreation, and I see all those students in my different classes. I've got some, early on undergraduate classes all the way up to graduate classes. So we get really specialized about how the deer stomach works, but we talk about where we've come in conservation in the US. And so I think there's something for everybody. You think of even foresters, how important the forest industry is for managing habitat for deer and so many other species. In wildlife management, we train people that become private consultants. They become agency managers, so for state and federal agencies, managing big game, small game, habitat, mentored hunting programs. We train people to become professors like me. And, we see folks that work as on the ground managers doing prescribed burning, selective harvest of trees, managing vegetation across the country. So there is something for everybody. And the pay has really risen over time. And so folks that come here and get a Bachelor of Science degree, they can work as a on the ground technician and manager. A lot of our students go on to a master's. Some of them do an undergrad degree in wildlife, and they do a master of forest business or some other related field, and they can work in the forest industry and impact wildlife in that way. And so I'd encourage people to check us out. And there's a lot of great schools, especially in the Southeast and across the country, that do similar work. But to think about that, you can go to school and learn about some of these species and habitats and ecosystems and the people that manage these systems, all of society that we work for to manage these systems. I think it's quite a blessing. And I will say it hasn't dampened my enthusiasm for hunting. I mean, I still can't wait to hear those crunching leaves coming my way and knowing that buck's coming, everything's coming together. And I still don't know anywhere near everything I need to know, despite millions of dollars of GPS collar studies across the country being done by us and other schools, and all these studies that we do in the laboratory. I still have so much to learn, and I love talking about it and having that curious nature that still drives us to do more and more research.
I'm glad to hear you say that. You always hear people say, be careful about
Yep, that ruined my,
turning your hobby into a job or your passion into a job. And it's good to hear you say that it hadn't dimmed your passion for it at all. I know that, when I was just getting, going to college, it feels overwhelming at times, to try to be able to pick out what exactly you want to do. And when it comes to choosing a curriculum or a path or that kind of thing, you're talking to a 17-year-old kid or an 18-year-old kid or a 20-year-old or even somebody older, maybe thinking about changing career paths. What matters to you in that moment? Like, is it you want somebody to come in and get a good broad base of knowledge and then kind of figure that path out as they go, or do you think somebody needs to fi be figuring it out, in high school?
No, I mean, I think I was fortunate in that I've kind of known for a long time what I wanted to do, and I followed that path. And most of our students aren't like that. And many of them are far more successful than me, that maybe they'll hire me someday. So it doesn't matter. I've seen folks come in that were undecided, and they're the best of the best in whatever their field is. I regularly talk to students that are interested, whether they're a high school student, or they're already in a program and they're wondering, is wildlife or some of these related fields for them, or is graduate school right for them? Sometimes we just jump on a 15-minute Zoom call and we sort out some of like, what can you expect? What kind of jobs can you expect? What's the salary going to be? What are you going to be doing day to day? And what industries are hiring based on what majors we have? So it's never too late. I've had students from literally dual enrollment high schoolers all the way up to folks in their 70s
Wow.
in my classes or my advisees, and things have worked out well for them. So people shouldn't be shy about reaching out to me and to others, maybe they're interested in waterfowl or, range management, whatever it may be. Reach out to somebody local. I was fortunate that I caught up to a biologist when I was a teenager who said, yeah, you can do this for a job. You better do well in school and stay off drugs, but do well in the sciences and math and communication is so important. And all of that has rung true for me. So the way our program works is students come into UGA as freshmen or they transfer over in their sophomore, junior year. I don't often see them until they're sophomores or juniors when they enter our professional program. So they go from classes that could be, oh, they could be 1,000 people in a class to many of our classes in our school are 15 to 30 people. And so you get to know your cohort, you get to know your professors. And I have to say, it's quite the family atmosphere. We've got a student lounge where a lot of people hang out, lots of study areas. We have events where families come, including their parents, my wife and child, and the school comes together. We break bread together. We enjoy kind of all of our mutual passions together. And so don't be afraid. University of Georgia's got 50 some thousand students. But here at Warnell, we're a small family. And I say, it's not in these silos. We've got forestry students that interact regularly with wildlife students and water resources students. We've got all these student clubs. They have all kinds of fun together. And so it's really like the time of their lives to come here and study their passions and then go out and have this broad network of people across the country that they can call on. So it's, I don't know. When I was a student, it was wonderful, and I've come back. And it's this family atmosphere where we're really training the best of the best, and they're going out and doing wonderful things that I'm just so proud of.
Very
Awesome.
cool. Sounds like you guys have an awesome thing going on over there. This has been a very eye-opening podcast.
Yeah, I saw what you did there. Yeah, I
Good
saw what you did
pun.
there. Yeah.
Yeah. Gino, we really enjoyed it today. Thank you for being a part of it. If people kind of like you're talking about, get involved in the community, if they are interested in this and kind of exploring a path, where would you point them to? Would you point them to a website? How would they get more information on the University of Georgia's Warnell School of Forestry and Natural Resources?
Yeah, they can easily search for the Warnell School, and they can also look at our website, ugadeerresearch.org. They can easily find my email and reach out to me, gdangelo@uga.edu, and we'll always get you pointed in the right direction. We'll help you find that information or that person that can direct you on the right path.
All right, folks, we're going to be right back. Y'all take a minute and check out some of our sponsors, Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply offer numerous items to help get your project done right the first time. They carry a variety of different panel profiles and your choice of colors and gauges with all the matching trim and accessories. They also offer a full line of hardware items and post-frame building design. Their friendly and knowledgeable sales representatives are always willing to help answer any questions or concerns you may have. Contact them with any questions or to get a free estimate today. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply, your metal roofing headquarters. Southern Seed and Feed. Do you want to provide better nutrients to your deer? If so, try Southern Buck Food Plot Blends. Your deer will love it. At Southern Seed and Feed, they specialize in making textured feed for horses, cattle, sheep, goats, hogs, chickens, small animals, and wildlife. Their products are proven irresistible, scientifically formulated to promote excellent herd health and hunter satisfaction. They supply products to various distributors throughout the South. So visit their website at southernseedfeed.com or call 662-726-2638 to find the dealer nearest you. Butch, today's podcast with Gino and listening to the research that they've done confirmed a lot of the things that I thought I knew about how deer see. I've always wondered how in the world they can have their head down eating and see you move. And now we know, like, isn't that wild that their eyeball is like a gyroscope and just they're getting the same picture whether their head's down or whether their head's up. And
It's a cool creature, man.
That's going to make me a lot more, I'm going to be a lot more still now when animals are close. I can tell you that. I would say I've gotten a little complacent as I've gotten older. I move a lot more in the stand than I did when I was a kid. I was almost scared to move. Now I'm like,
Same.
I'm kind of moving a lot. That was one of the things that was really interesting to me. What did you learn from today?
One big takeaway that I definitely picked up on was, we're always diligent about looking, say you're hunting the edge of a greenfield bow hunting, so to speak. That deer is going to walk out in the field and be looking at you from directly in front of you. We look at that backdrop, make sure you're not standing out there, make sure, the tree's about the same width as your lock on, or you're halfway hidden directly in front of that deer. But what if he comes out directly to your left? Are you
90
going to,
degrees, yeah.
are you literally going to be sticking out there like a sore thumb?
Yeah.
That was something that I picked up on. I don't know that I necessarily, like with a climbing stand, for instance, if you're jacked up on a ridge, or you're going to be seen from all different kinds of angles if that deer comes out.
That's what's so challenging about bow hunting, right? Because you're trying to get close. If you're hunting with a rifle, yeah, get 40
Right.
feet up the tree. It doesn't really necessarily
Yeah,
matter.
just get a
You
hundred
get
yards
above
away.
their field of vision, get further away. They don't have that visual clarity. It's almost like, hey, if you're rifle hunting or firearm hunting, you can get away with a lot more. But when you're trying to get close, you got to really think about it from he like he said, they can see 300 degrees. You got to approach camouflage in your tree stand from that same field of view. You got to make sure from 300 degrees around you, basically every direction except for the trunk of the tree, that you've got breakup and backdrop. You can't
All the
be
way
silent
around.
all the way around. Yeah, you're going to be just added another level of
Anxiety
OCD
to my hunting.
to the stand setup. It's already hard enough, it seems like, sometimes to find the right place to get. And that backdrop being the most important thing, that breakup, I've wondered for years, like, how important is it really that I have gray camo on when it's later in the season,
Wintertime,
it's gray
right?
outside, and green camo on when it's green and all that. And it almost seems like it's not so much that you're trying to blend in with what's there, you're trying to not stand out with
That's
what's
right.
there,
Yeah. Try not to be an anomaly
Right. You could
or an
probably get
inconsistency.
away with, a grayish camo in a green environment because there's lots of shadows and the leaves are out, and you're not going to stand out as much gray in a green. But if you've got on bright green early season camo and you're wearing that in the late season, you're going to look like a blob in the timberline. And so there is some importance to the color of your camo, but also the pattern. And then, I thought it was also very interesting how you talked about how the further you got away, the patterns start to blend together. And
Yeah.
so what looks really visually detailed at a close distance is going to look like just a dark spot a
Yeah.
little further out. You want to have some bigger areas of contrast in your camouflage pattern.
Yeah. One thing that he also said was, and there's a million different patterns out there. It seems like it's
Sure.
just crazy these days, and there's all kind of the but what he was saying about the, totally matching from head to toe might make you stand out more.
Right.
Sometimes if you have if you have a form-fitting jacket, form-fitting pants, form-fitting hat, that's all the exact same pattern, especially in little bitty patterns, that makes sense to me that you're going to stand out.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what makes it fun, though. I mean,
That's right. That's why we keep doing
if it was
it.
easy, I don't know. I've been playing a lot more golf.
That's right. That was a fun one, man. Enjoyed it.
Me too. Well, that's going to wrap it up for us this week. Appreciate you joining us. We want to make it easy for you to listen, so here's a handy option for you. To get the podcast emailed to you each week, just text the word hunting to 773-770-4377. Again, just text the word hunting to 773-770-4377. You'll join our email list, and wherever you are listening to podcasts, go ahead, subscribe, rate, and review. Send us a written review. We'd love to hear from you. If you've got a show topic that you are interested in and like to see us cover, just email us at pros@landhunting.com. That's going to do it for us. Y'all stay safe out there. We'll talk to you next time.